The Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, Mondays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy, and how you can make the most of your own life, right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, and as always, I have a very interesting guest today. She is Dr. Barbara Fisher from Rancho Santa Margarita near Irvine in California. Before getting to Dr. Fisher, I had two things to talk to you about. First, I want to again encourage everyone to come to our conference, and I want to say a few more words about that. And then I want to bring up a general subject that occurs to me that Barbara and I, Dr. Fisher and I, should address today, which I hadn't really thought a lot about when I chatted with her on the phone last night. And that subject is the response of children and families to trauma. Trauma as experienced in Japan and trauma as witnessed from the United States and other countries looking on at what's happening in Japan. And I'm going to have a few words to say about that and give Dr. Fisher a little time to think about the subject I did not prepare her or me for. Hey, don't miss the conference. If you can come to the conference September 8th, 9th, and 10th in Syracuse. It's the Empathic Therapy Conference. People are coming from all over the world. They're coming from countries in the Far East. They're coming from Africa. They're coming from the Middle East. They're coming from Australia. They're coming from Canada. And, of course, they're coming even more so from the United States. But we should have maybe 40, 50 or more people from around the world. And we're going to have a lot of really interesting things going on. I'll give you one example. It's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, 8th through the 10th in April, not long, a few weeks away. You can find out all about it on empathictherapy.org, empathictherapy.org. To give you a taste, on Saturday morning for 2 hours, we are going to have a unique presentation. Really, I don't think there's been one like this before. It's a tragedy that's going to be described, but I think you'll be transformed in a positive way. The panel will feature a woman who lost her daughter when she was 12 to suicide while taking an SSRI antidepressant, one of the newer antidepressants. And she's going to talk about her loss and about these drugs. She's become a reformer. And her daughter is going to be there to talk about her loss with her sister dying so young, so very, very young. And then the lawyer who took the case, which was settled, will be there. And then me, the medical expert in this case that was settled, will be there. And then there'll be some other family members on the panel. That's just a taste of the interesting and unusual things. And there'll be a lot of people talking about alternative therapy where it shows that human services, human interventions, therapy and counseling can help even people with dementia and Alzheimer's and head injuries and soldiers coming back from the war. It's going to be, and there'll be fun things. My first training film is going to be shown Saturday night for how to do therapy. And it's really for everyone interested in empathic relating, teachers, students, husbands and wives, anybody interested in how to really engage other human beings is going to benefit from coming to this conference, the Empathic Therapy Conference. Go to empathictherapy.org, and you only got about 4 weeks before it actually comes to pass now. Now, the subject that I thought is just so compelling today that we ought to bring up, I'm going to speak about it for a few minutes and then invite Dr. Fisher in to add her thoughts. And she should have some really good thoughts because she's one of the few people I know that's gotten an MSW and found she so enjoyed doing clinical work that she then got a PhD in psychology, all at Ohio State. And I know she works with families and children, and that she and I have a lot in common from our brief discussions together. Well, we're looking right now with what's happening in Japan with roughly two kinds of trauma, the trauma of being there and the trauma of witnessing. Both can be very serious. At the time of 9/11, I was not in Ithaca, New York, as I am now. I was in Washington, D.C., and remember one of the planes drove into the Pentagon. So there was smoke rising in the sky, and I had friends and patients who were very close to that horrific event. The night of 9/11, cars were piled up out a block away from my house trying to escape up Wisconsin Avenue, and most of them didn't get out of the city or barely got out of the city. People were really, really frightened. And I got a call from the major local radio station asking if I would come in downtown and go on the air on a panel with the members of the radio station and talk about how could families and children deal with this fear, with this experience, and what was the best approach. And so I'm going down the road into D.C. as people still fearing further attacks or the after effects of the attacks that had occurred are streaming in the other direction. It was quite easy driving in our direction because absolutely nobody was going there. And when we got downtown to the studio, it was quite striking for the first time. There was security everywhere, and there was a new security inside the studio. Times had changed. And when I got on the radio station and feeling nervous and anxious but glad to be of service, I realized that my basic fear was gone. Incidentally, my wife refused to let me go alone, and she came down with me to the station and through all of this. And what I realized and what I already knew and what was reinforced was that what really mattered during a trauma like this was the relationships that were within the family, and that children are more frightened by their parents' fear and their parents' withdrawal in anxiety during trauma than they are upset by the trauma itself. It was known, for example, in Great Britain that children did better staying in London during the Blitz of London, during the horrendous bombing. They were better huddled in basements and of course, mostly in the subways, better there, frightened, than away from their parents in the country. So the key for parents and children is for the parents, as much as possible, to handle their fears by understanding that the most important thing for their children at these times is their presence, their caring, their involvement, their sharing. And that's true now if your kids are watching some of the reports from Japan from this terrible catastrophe of, it's a triple catastrophe of earthquake, tsunami, and atomic high risk from atomic meltdown. To remember that the single most important thing we have to give to our loved ones is each other at those times. And some of us will be called away. And then it's up to those left behind to fill in and to make sure that the children are taken care of. Those are some of my opening thoughts. Dr. Barbara Fisher, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dr. Bregan. I'm very happy to be here. I have some thoughts on the trauma that these people are experiencing. And one of the things that I've noted over the years is that the mind goes into shock, and that shock is protective for a short time. And I would imagine that then most of these people are feeling that shock and people will describe it as just being an automaton. They just go forward, but don't know why they're. So I think that shock serves us. It's a very disorganizing experience, and it's a little like a deconstruction. And I liked what you said, that staying close as families, but also other nations in this case responding would be very organizing to them, to the people there. So it would be a reconstruction of reality for them. And I can imagine, only imagine, that it must be very unreal at this point. So I love the way other nations are responding and going there. So the closeness of others, I think, is paramount.
You're listening to Dr. Barbara Fisher from Rancho Santa Margarita near Irvine in California. Barbara, I think that you just made a profound statement that sort of carries my thinking to another level about this. You're comparing the chaos and, in a sense, the anarchy and the disintegration of the social structure with what goes on in the person's mind or spirit and how that is protected by numbing.
Yes.
And I think that's really important. Tell us more if you have more thoughts.
It's just that the brain, I see the brain as it's like the body heals a cut without your concentrating on it. It just does that. And I see that kind of thing happening with the brain, that if there's a traumatic event, then a great deal of inhibition occurs in the brain to protect the organization of that individual. That's something I've sort of come away with after years of working with people. But I have such a high regard for the brain seems to have a need to organize, keep itself organized. And I love that. hopefully that's what, as counselors, that's what we help do with the people, is to help them reconstruct and reorganize. So...
In working with people who have been through trauma, and also listening to people who have a lot more experience than I do, who are in the military, who help people, one of the interesting things that corresponds with what you're saying, and this is really thinking in a new way for me about it, because I think you bring in a good perspective, is how similar PTSD symptoms are to head injury symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
So when a soldier or soldiers hit one of these IEDs and it compresses the brain with the pressure and causes a lot of traumatic brain harm, and they also have PTSD, it's very hard to tell the effects apart, because the injury to the spirit or the psyche and the injury to the brain are very similar in some of their effects.
Mm-hmm. So you were talking about traumatic brain injury?
Yes, and PTSD, and comparing the two.
Mm-hmm.
Do you work in this area at all? Do you have much experience with trauma particularly?
I did my dissertation actually on the effects of battering, assault and battery, with women primarily. So, which I believe creates a chronic trauma, and Judith Herman has dealt with this, and she likes the diagnosis of complex PTSD, and I believe that. I haven't done a lot of work with acute PTSD. I've had one or two Vietnam vets a long time ago, and I worked with them a little bit.
So you've been working with women and. And I'm sure children, because you do family work, who have been battered, and it can be hard to tell the difference between the physical and the emotional battering. Although, unless you've had a bomb blow up nearby you, the emotional battering is likely to leave, I think, the deepest scars.
It injures the brain. It injures, I think, the organization of the brain, and it's a threat. It's an extreme threat to integrity. And I think that's one of the reasons why we have such a protest. You mentioned in one of your books that we don't like to hear things about us. We don't like to be wrong. So we don't want to hear that we're wrong. So there always seems to be a great resistance to that. And I think that underneath, there must be that we must feel a threat to our integrity if someone tells us we're wrong. I mean, we could be wrong, but there seems to be an initial resistance to that. So I think the mind has a strong tendency to keep itself organized.
That's also the cognitive dissonance concept, that two contradictory ideas, the mind or the brain, however you want to look at it, doesn't want to hold them.
No, it'll take care of it.
This is reminds me of electroshock treatment. People aren't aware that we are inflicting head injury on probably several hundred thousand people in this country every year with shock treatment. It's done in usually a few places in every major city and in private hospitals, hospital wards, university centers. And during shock treatment, people's brains go through traumatic brain injury and they get disorganized very badly, as you're saying. And that sometimes induces in them abject terror. But the brain tends to push us toward getting numb or getting artificially high, those protective mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
I think talking about shock treatment makes me so angry, I'm stuttering.
But
these protective mechanisms of numbness or silly euphoria. Mm-hmm. But some people go into abject terror as they experience their personalities coming apart.
I hadn't thought of that particular aspect, but I could see where that would be. What I've seen is a fogging and a permanent loss of memory.
Yes, I think that's the most common effect long-term for trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Another interesting thing that I have actually learned more about from listening to people who, some of whom will be speaking at our conference, April 8th through 10th.
I'm going to try to come.
You're going to come?
I'm going to try.
Okay.
I'm investigating. I'm online trying to get flights, easy flights there. So,
I'm sorry. Come. I hope you'll come, and we can try to find a place for you, and if we can, where you can share some of your wisdom with people. It's hard at the last minute, but we can give it a try.
Okay, I'd love that. But ECTs,
go ahead.
The ECTs, the people I've seen just are so fogged over. And when I ask them about their histories, it's very sketchy, very vague. They just don't remember. And
That's right.
And this was a long time ago that I saw this. I was on a mental health unit I did my residency on a mental health unit of 24 beds and saw this quite a lot. ECTs were done quite a lot then. And I thought, like you, it looked like brain damage to me. It was an insult to the brain. And how could that be healing? First, do no harm. So I'm just as angry as you are about this kind of thing. We ought not to be doing this to human beings.
Yeah, people ask me sometimes, what sort of patients get ECT?
Mm-hmm.
And I explained that getting ECT does not reflect on the condition of the patient, but of the moral condition of the psychiatrist.
Right.
So it's much more who you go to than who you are.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a dreadful situation. I'd like to get us to be thinking more about the kinds of help that children need in particular. I think it's a special interest of both of ours. When they've been through trauma and when they are young adults, do you work much with the sexually abused children and physically, emotionally abused children?
I don't. But recently, I usually get behavioral problems, adolescent behavioral problems, but that typically reverts to we have a family problem. And so we deal more. But I have not. I've most recently had a young 14-year-old who was actually being more verbally abused by her older brother, who was considerably older than she was. And I reported it. That's one way I deal with that, is I have no tolerance for abuse of any kind, either verbal or physical. So it gets reported. And then I'm very happy to work with the family, but we have to set certain standards of conduct. And so that's kind of my starting point. I think that the children who are being abused must, you bring them to me, they must feel protected and be protected. And that's a good start, I think, to having them open up and the family start working on some of these very serious issues.
Well, how do families respond when you just stick the truth to them?
They're some of them get mad at me and think I've caused it all, but I remind them that I didn't. And I don't point fingers and I don't blame. I hold parents responsible, but I don't blame because I think they're all doing the best they know how. And many of the parents have been abused themselves, so they just pass this on to their children without thinking, basically. And so what I do, hopefully, is to kind of wake them up and have them kind of look at how negative this is and present alternatives to them on ways to relate to their children, on ways to see their children, because typically it's pretty negative. Well, they'll ascribe sinister motives to a child. Well, he's just doing this because he wants to make me angry, things like that. I said, no, he does. He doesn't. So I immediately begin presenting these alternative ways of conceptualizing their children. And it really begins to help. And I have not run into a parent that didn't tune in and learn. It's either that or they left therapy altogether. So, but most of them really want to learn.
Now, you're talking about private practice, right?
Yes. And that's what I've done for my career, basically.
Yeah.
And
so
I love
one of the
doing
dreadful
it.
Things is that when you get to, well, recently, for example, I did a two-hour consultation with a clinic on these very same subjects we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And the parents who were there are not necessarily there because they want to be. And often there's some compulsion from the state mm-hmm. for them to be involved. Mm-hmm. And it's so different for the therapist working in public clinics than it is for us in private practice, where the vast majority of people who come to us have a certain amount of both psychological integrity and ethical mm-hmm. integrity, and they're able to participate and eager to. It gets a lot harder with the clinics.
I would think so.
To get the kids involved. And yeah, there you got to start looking at really social welfare kinds of interventions, not necessarily giving money, but mm-hmm. but providing broad services to strengthen these families.
Yes.
But we're fortunate in private practice. You and I are very much on the same page about dealing with the family and seeing all the issues that children have as mm-hmm. going to the family, and also I'm sure the school. But the bullying and the damage can come from places unexpected. The older brother you mentioned mm-hmm. can come from priests and
yes.
ministers and rabbis. It can come from
right.
coaches. It can
school
come
teachers.
From
yeah.
A whole variety mm-hmm. of people, babysitters, nannies.
Yeah.
Anybody in a position to do good is in a position to do harm,
right.
unfortunately. One of the things I like to remind parents is that the difficulties children get into are always, of course, partly influenced for better and worse by us, but also by chance, by siblings, by
mm-hmm.
school,
right.
by television and radio. But the parents are in the best position to help heal the child.
Right.
So I try to spend a lot of time on setting aside what caused these issues, and we may want to look at it some, and we will look at it some. The real issue is, Mom, Dad, you're the one who, before this child grows up, has the opportunity to give as much as possible and to help the child as much as possible, and hopefully will enlist the cooperation of the child. So think of yourself not as the cause, but as mm-hmm. the solution, mm-hmm. the one person in the position to do the most good. And that helps people a lot.
Right. One of the things, along with that, one of the things I work with parents is to engage their executive function with their children. You teach them that in early adolescence, their frontal lobes aren't fully developed yet. So that's their decision-making. That's where the judgment is. I said, it's not there yet. And so that's where you come in. It's not the only place they come in, but it's very important for you to assume that executive function and help make decisions for them. And they may be resistive. They may want to go out on a date at 13, and you will say, well, you're too young. I said, that is using the executive function because they can't make that judgment yet. So that's just one small example of the kind of teaching of parenting that goes on, and parents seem to be quite responsive to that.
I love that. I'm going to actually say to the next parent I see, you're the one with the fully grown frontal lobes. Let's use them.
Yes.
Your kids don't have them yet.
That's right. And, you know, it sometimes takes a while for them to get that, because I think the parents are expecting that their kid, and he may, you know, may be bright, four-point average, your kid is not fully developed yet. Just can't do it. It isn't that he won't. He just can't.
And sometimes, as my wife and I were talking today, sometimes children can turn around really quickly if the adults turn around, too.
Yes.
So you may not have to go through this torture for 5 years. If you really turn around, especially when your kid is young, you're going to see a turnaround
Yes. That
may be faster than you could have imagined.
Right. And, you know, parents, I think, as their children come into adolescence, are expecting negative things, and that's another problem, too. They're expecting their child to be acting out. And so I disabuse them of that. I said, that's not necessarily true. They're changing, and they're edging toward adulthood, which is what you want them to do. But they need your love, and they need your approval. And so I think parents, you know, sit up and take notice and listen to that kind of thing and incorporate that into their lives. The other thing I've run into with families is there's considerable irritability at home being exchanged. And I'll ask parents, how often do you get angry with your child? And they'll underestimate it first.
Yes.
So I'll get down to the nitty-gritty and say, how many times a day? How many times a week? And it turns out to be quite a lot. And I said, this may be why your child, regardless of the reason, this may be why your child is withdrawing and becoming angry with you and acting out. So let's take a look at it.
Barbara Fisher, it's a pleasure to be talking to you, to be talking to a really dedicated therapist about the nuts and bolts of helping people.
What we do, yes.
Yeah. I'm really glad. That was one of the things that struck me as we talked on the phone, was that you're just a straightforward, dedicated therapist. You really believe in what you're doing. It's what your life is about.
Yes.
And I think that's wonderful. We'll be taking a break in a minute or two.
Okay.
And I think when we come back, I want to continue on this theme and maybe look at, you know, what are some of the opening observations that we make as therapists to help families in need, you know, try to share them with folks out
mm-hmm.
there.
Mm-hmm.
Some of our listeners are therapists and professionals, and some are families
mm-hmm.
and parents, and I don't know how many kids we have, but maybe there are some out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to be sharing that with them as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any additional thoughts before we go to break?
In dealing with parents? Well, one of the things I do in the first session when they bring in an adolescent is to see the parent and the adolescent for 20 minutes or so that the parent can state what they think the problem is. Then I see the child for the rest of the time and begin establishing a relationship with them where they're able to open up and talk about what's going on. And I help them understand what it means to talk honestly about things at home or at school. And I always explore for any kind of bullying that goes on in school as well. I've worked with schools in the past to stop that, where they typically want to turn that over to the children. I say the children, by definition, can't handle it. So that's
we need to tell the principals that they're the ones with the fully developed frontal lobes.
Right.
And they need to exert their moral authority.
Right.
One of the things families have so much trouble with in modern times is exerting a loving but moral authority with their children.
Yes.
The parents got to believe in themselves as the ones in charge.
Right. Exactly.
And it's interesting how many similar conclusions we've come to. I think we're practical people, you and I, and we really try to look at what works. Because
exactly.
I think it's interesting to see the common feelings we have.
Yes.
We'll be taking a break now
Okay.
We're on the ball here at my station. Katie, are we ready to go?
I hear the music.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Gary Knoll. I've been on radio for 37 years, every day, and I'm pleased that the Progressive Radio Network exists, because this is the one form that brings together some of the most important, probing, creative, and dynamic minds on the planet. Join us each and every day, 24/7, on the Progressive Radio Network, your home for independent thinking.
Every Sunday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, join the founders of the Godspeed Institute for Spiritual Learning, Carol and Michael Hallenbeck, for Godspeed, an enlightening and informative journey into the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Through conversations with experts worldwide, this weekly live call-in program is an on-air classroom aimed at helping listeners gain exposure to and insight into religious and spiritual practices around the world, every Sunday, 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, I'm Mike Adams, the editor-in-chief and key writer of naturalnews.com and co-founder of the nonprofit site consumerwellness.org. I'll be starting a special segment on the Progressive Radio Network called The Health Ranger with Mike Adams. I'll be interviewing everyone from Dr. Jane Goodall to Suzanne Summers. Find out the latest in natural healing news and easy ways to live a healthier and more holistic lifestyle. So tune in on Saturdays at 6 p.m. Eastern every week on the Progressive Radio Network to hear The Health Ranger with Mike Adams.
Driving you crazy? Do you have a cheating boyfriend or girlfriend? An ex you can't let go of? An obnoxious boss? Adult kids who won't listen? I'm Hollis Polk, and I fix relationship problems. Your life, your relationship with Hollis Polk offers you practical solutions for all sorts of people problems. Listen and call in Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. Pacific, or download the podcast at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
You're listening to Bhavani, and I'd like to welcome you every Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network to join me for my show called I Eat Green, where every Wednesday we will talk about eating healthy and eating sustainably for our planet. So join me every Wednesday from 5 to 6.
You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan. And I'm talking today with my guest, Dr. Barbara Fisher, who has an MSW and a PhD in psychology as well. Been in private practice for a couple of decades. And She's from Rancho Santa Margarita near Irvine. And Barbara, I can give you your phone number?
Uh-huh, certainly. It's 949-766-9756.
I'd like to do a couple of things in the next half hour. I'd like to first talk some with you about the psychiatric meds, because we both have a lot of feelings about that and giving them to children in particular. And then go back to the theme of what do we tell families? How do we help families get together? One of the things on this earth that most upsets me is the psychiatric medicating of our children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we used to say that there was a famous movie that had a priest in it that ran a home for kids, and I think the saying was something about there were no children who were incorrigible or irredeemable.
Was this Boys Town?
Boys Town.
Yeah, okay.
But in psychiatry, we constantly declare large numbers, 20-30% of America's mm-hmm. children, as in a sense irredeemable by ordinary educational, mm-hmm. psychological, mm-hmm. and spiritual means, and that they have to be drugged.
Yes. It's unconscionable.
I hardly know where to begin, other than to say that we are poisoning children, that mm-hmm. all of the psychiatric drugs
right.
are neurotoxins in effect.
Yes.
That is, they go specifically to the neurotransmitters of the brain. They sneak in through all the protections of the blood-brain barrier. They disrupt the neurotransmitters.
Exactly.
And the only good that can come of it is if you prefer a medicated child. That is, a child who is less in touch, less able to communicate, less rambunctious,
mm-hmm. more
less
controllable,
less spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. What did you want to say?
You know, one of the they're more controllable, but they lose their exuberance for life, and that is so sad. I was a consultant for the state of Ohio in their Social Security Disability Bureau, and ADHD and ADD were delisted in, I think, 1995. And I have, for as long as I've been in practice and dealt with adolescents, I have never diagnosed any of these children with ADHD or ADD. But I'm certain that at least a quarter of the children in Orange County are diagnosed with that and taking medications. And not just the is it methylphenidates, but also the neuroleptics. So it's alarming.
That's terrifying, because we now know that drugs like Abilify and Seroquel and Zyprexa, Risperdal, they cause diabetes,
mm-hmm.
they cause obesity, they raise the blood pressure,
mm-hmm.
they raise the cholesterol. They're
mm-hmm.
a prescription for eventual heart attacks, and they shorten lifespan by years and years. There's just more and more data on this, by years and years and years. And we're giving them the kids. It's a crime. Absolute
crime.
Yes, it
is. I agree. It is.
Now, do you ever see kids that you wish you could medicate?
No.
Or send to the psychiatrist?
Never, never. I've only had actually two patients for as long as I've been in practice whose anxiety was so high and so intense that I felt an antidepressant would help lower the emotional intensity so that they could focus on their problems. But that's only two out of, I don't know how many, over a couple of decades.
Well, I'm sure I've had many more than that
mm-hmm.
I felt,
mm-hmm.
Whoa, I don't know what to do with all this intense emotion. But what
right.
I do, Barbara, is I just, you know, which I'm sure you do most all the time, I just work harder. I just try to figure out what in the world can I do to help this
right.
individual. And sometimes it may be things that are outside of my therapy, but in another kind of therapy. Maybe there's a group therapy that would help. Maybe
mm-hmm.
There's some educational process that will help. Maybe even a health process of some kind. Maybe some good massage and acupuncture.
Mm-hmm.
I always figure that drugs just aren't going to be a resort for me. And even though I can just reach into my drawer and write a prescription, I don't do it. I just don't do it. But I do, of course, write prescriptions helping people, including children, come off the medications.
Yes.
But it's so good to hear that you've come to that conclusion. Now, did my work play any role in your coming to that conclusion? Or did you come to that before you read my books?
I think I was already sort of gathering sidestream data. And then that's when I saw you on the Donahue show. And this is when Toxic Psychiatry was published. And all I could say during that entire show was yes, yes, yes.
That's
at
wonderful.
Last. A ray
and, you
of
know,
hope.
Donahue
because I was getting no validation from anybody around me, not the psychiatrist or the psychologist. Oh, it's medication. It's medication.
And I remember Donahue. Those were the very early years where Toxic was published in, I forget, 91 or 92. And the Donahue show was probably back in 1992. Very early years. I was the first one out there.
Okay.
Saying these things, and Donahue was all freaked out. I mean, he didn't want to let go of medications.
I noticed that. Well, he at least gave you airtime, and I thought that's a positive.
But, that was positive.
But
gave me airtime, tried
to
slap me around a little bit, but
I probably held my own.
Times are changing. Times are changing in some good ways and in some bad. I mean, the good ways are the public now really has a growing understanding of this, but the mass media, the big TV shows are actually covering this less than before. I think they're even more under the influence of the drug companies.
Yes.
Because after I came along and wrote Toxic Psychiatry, and then I got in lawsuits or product liability suits against the drug companies, they really ramped up their attempt to control the media. And they have so many ways of connecting to the media.
Yes.
They have interlocking boards of directors with the media.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these big show people or radio show TV people have friends who are psychiatrists, or they're being taken care of in some way by psychiatry taken to dinner and praised and awarded. And, of course, we who are opposing the drugs don't have that power, money, or influence.
No.
So I think there's actually less big media access now. But the books keep coming out. There are more and more people writing what we believe. And there's more and more on the web, on the Internet.
Yes. Well, I think I wrote a blurb to Ginger about KCET, which is our public station out here. And they had actually a promotion. They wouldn't call it that. They had a promotion of ADD, ADHD, and listing all this, and you may have this, your child may have this, this is the list of things. And it was appalling, and they aired that about, because I kept checking, about five times. And I want to write a letter.
These are public service announcements, if you can believe that. That's what those probably are.
Yeah, and it was a promotion. It was, but these, most of these stations are corporate owned, so they're going to make decisions in their best interest.
Well, I feel deeply about this issue, and I remember debating a pediatrician on this, and he said, don't you think you've had one or two children who could benefit from psychiatric drugs? And I said, doctor, I wouldn't know which one to poison.
I like that.
Maybe I overdid it. Nobody ever debates me twice.
No. Well,
do you have more thoughts on the medications? I think it's just really important for people to know that here you are. You're a very experienced professional. You're not a psychiatrist, and yet you've only twice in your career, from what you're saying, felt that you needed to refer somebody for medications. And maybe after this show, that'll be the end of that, and you'll never do it again.
There were two cases of extreme anxiety. Some people who are profoundly depressed do a little better if they're given medication for a while. So it isn't just two people in 20 years. But I was just talking about anxiety.
I'll tell you how I help people who are profoundly depressed. And we're going to have an example of that on my training film. which will be published and available around the time of the conference and will be available and shown partially at the conference. When somebody is profoundly depressed, I explain to them that the profundity of their depression is a reflection on how deep their yearnings are for a really wonderful, grand, creative, loving life. But if they didn't have that level of some knowledge that life could be all that better, they would just be blah. But because they know somewhere that it can be better and want somewhere for it to be better. So I tell them, hey, being profoundly depressed doesn't worry me. Just promise me you won't kill yourself from week to week, and we'll help you rise out of that depression to not just not being depressed, but to really fulfilling these needs.
You can be delighted with this life.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
And some of these individuals, I don't think, ever experienced that. If they came out of child abuse, they never have. They can't even contemplate it. So presenting that, I think, is wonderful. I don't present it in exactly that way, but it's similar.
And it's very true. I think this is really considered not even a brilliant insight among people who work a lot with heavy child abuse, because what's found with when you have really heavy child abuse is you find that some of these young children find these incredibly creative ways of surviving. They make up friends. They make up parents.
Yes.
They make up fantasy lives. They go to special places. They find secret places to go to. And they develop a richness of inner life, which then if they can be encouraged to deeply believe in themselves and to debrief these terrible childhoods, they come out with more appreciation of life, more creativity than many, many other people. So I always approach the deeply wounded, and I consider that I was myself in many ways a deeply wounded, although not with so much excuse for being deeply wounded as a lot of the people who come to me, but I had my own deeply woundedness, and I think it helped me become a therapist and a reformer.
Exactly.
And I really encourage you. You feel that way about yourself?
No, well, I don't. Yes, I've had problems, and I had been in therapy years ago, and it worked. It was marvelous stuff, and that's where I really got my start, and that's where my interest developed from there. So, yes, I had problems of my own, and I sorted through them and came to terms with them. And what I find with people, myself and people, is that they have a flawed, if they're abused as children, they have a flawed relationship with themselves. And so I teach that that's one of the most important relationships you'll ever establish. So we go in and start digging out some of the old dysfunctional stuff and replacing it with pretty much like you said, the goodness of them deep down. And we go searching for that, and they find it every time, every time. And then they begin to grow, and we were talking earlier about organizing, the brain organizes. Then the brain begins to organize around these concepts, these positive concepts, instead of the negative feelings they have about themselves when they are abused. So I love my work. I think you can tell that.
Yes, I view doing therapy as an incredible privilege, as an honor. Before Freud, with all his mishigas, with all his mistakes and bad ideas, he was the first one to really, really listen and listen and listen.
Yes,
and since Freud, except for priests, it's the first time that those of us who aren't in a priestly role can be in a kind of secular priestly role and be able to share people's lives and to help them and to understand and to be trusted. And I view it as a sacred trust with every person.
Yes.
It's one of the guidelines. I don't know if you've gotten a chance to look at the guidelines for empathic therapy that I wrote with the help of about 6 or 8 or 10 other people. They're up on our empathictherapy.org website. But it starts with, we treasure the people we work with.
Right.
And your idea about going back into the childhood of the individual to put them in touch with themselves is so good. The way the language I use for that is that I'll say to the person I'm working with, I want you to become empathic toward yourself as a mm-hmm. child. I want you to care about yourself as a child. Let's go back and see what that little boy or girl was like. Because right now you feel there must have been something the matter with you. Because almost all these grown-ups feel there's something the matter. That's your experience too, right? That's just universal. Yes. What's the matter with me that I got abused? And when they go back and they see themselves as children and what they went through, they can begin to understand that they were like every other child and every other kitten and every other puppy. Mm-hmm. Undeserving of abuse and that they have a right to life.
Your fault.
Yeah.
But a child thinks in an egocentric way. It's the only way they can think. They don't stand back and say, gee, you're not being a very good parent right now. They just turn it on themselves.
In severe abuse situations or even in moderate abuse, if you hint to a parent that they're at fault, then your life's at risk. Maybe even your physical life. So they not only naturally in their egocentric way turn on themselves, but also out of a survival instinct, you don't want to rile
the oppressor. Perpetrator.
Yeah, these kids learn to study the faces of their parents and their big siblings and aunts and uncles to make sure they're staying out of trouble for fear of the consequences. And they end up, having to view it like, I'll stay out of trouble, I'm to blame, I hope I can control it by blaming myself.
Exactly.
And staying out of trouble.
And they're hyper-vigilant, people.
Yeah, yes. Do you have any other thoughts about people who are now, young people who are now witnessing on radio and television, these events? Have you any experience with it, of what's going on in Japan and the fear of that happening in the United States, which is a reality?
I had during 9/11, there were a lot of adolescents brought to me who were having panic attacks. But I interviewed the parents and the adolescents, and it turns out that the parents had CNN on 24 hours a day. And so I basically educated the parents and taught them that your child is listening to these very anxiety-producing comments, and they can't do anything about it. They're not old enough, and they're not in a position. So you may want to turn off the television for a while. So in those cases, it was a matter of exposure, and then helping the parents and the children sort of be closer to one another. But other than that, I probably won't have people calling regarding this.
People don't usually call for help around these issues. It comes up in the context of their being there for other reasons because it just seems so natural. Of course, I'm scared and frightened. That's reality. There's nothing I can do about it. And a person has to actually get the idea, a parent has to get the idea that it's not just the reality, it's whether your child gets a chance to talk to you about it, whether they're watching by themselves, and so on.
And the amount they're watching it, because it's a repeat, and that can be, that can create a considerable anxiety in children. So
one of the things I've already talked on the show about is the problem of kids getting addicted to the media, the new media, and the social networking and so on. Do you have any thoughts for parents on how you can help your kids get off of that stuff?
Well, I help them engage their executive function. I teach them that your child is being influenced. What gets through to the brain are these flicker of the pixels on a monitor. And the brain tends to adapt to that. And then your child wants to play video games again and again and again. So I said, you arbitrarily have to disconnect him or her. You have to set some standards at home for this. Don't let them sit at the computer all day long. So they're getting quite a bit of that. There was a book called Ritalin Nation that came out back in the 90s, I think,
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember the author's name. I apologize for that. But he did a very good job of detailing out how a child's mind can be influenced by the electronics. So I think it bodes well for us to look at that and regulate that with children.
Again and again, we come back to it's so important for parents to exert their moral authority. Mm-hmm. Now, by the time the parents get to us, or to me, they're usually they're almost always fighting heavily with their children mm-hmm. about practically everything that comes along.
Right.
And one of the things I suggest to parents, and I wonder what you think about this, I suggest to parents that they exert a moratorium on everything that isn't life-threatening, that they just lay back from control issues, except for one thing, that they tell their kids from now on the house is going to be respectful, that mm-hmm. If you want anything, you want to go out, you want to play, you want to go to your room and watch TV or watch, mm-hmm. whatever you want to do, it requires respectful exchanges.
Mm-hmm.
Not even necessarily loving because we're so angry at each other, but mm-hmm. respectful changes. And then back off from the necessity of controlling all
right.
the other things, because once you establish respect, then you can talk about, reach
yes.
agreements about all the other things. So that is my mantra in
mm-hmm.
first sessions, that first we'll be respectful, then we'll mm-hmm. be loving, and we'll actually be able to work out a lot of these problems, but still
right.
mom and dad are in charge.
And I think I did do a very similar thing by presenting, what are your family's standards of conduct? What do you want them to be? And so we get in to define those. And typically, that doesn't include being angry with one another every 5 minutes.
Right, right, absolutely.
Now, I've thought of that in terms of our country. I'd like to see our standards of conduct improved. but it's kind of a novel idea for families.
Well, it's throughout the world, of course.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we just take the next step up from the family,
mm-hmm.
we have got to insist that our schools exert standards.
Yes.
They are chaotic. Principals are not exerting moral authority.
Right.
They're more worried about lawsuits and being politically
mm-hmm.
correct than about stopping bullying on a simple
mm-hmm.
level.
And they're not. Some of the schools are doing a good job with that, especially after this spate of suicides we saw with gay kids. They're holding some assemblies and some classes. Some of the schools are not, and they're still pretty much free-willing in the boys' gyms on discriminatory terms.
Yes, so, and all the meetings and all the conferences
mm-hmm.
and all the, quote, communication exercises don't mean anything unless there's the moral authority above
yes.
it that says you will not, as children, be permitted to harm each other.
Exactly.
Zero toleration.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
And that's a parent's job as much mm-hmm. as possible, too. You
mm-hmm.
can't stop your kids always from fighting, but it is your job to set that tone
mm-hmm.
And really to begin with, it is such a simple formula. Let go of the homework. Let go
mm-hmm.
of making them play the piano for a while. Let go of this and let go of that. But start
right.
with, we are going to have peace in the home.
Yes.
That's the
right.
beginning.
A top priority.
Yeah.
And you will see after a while.
I'm in charge of the peace. Yeah.
You will see the anxiety and anger decrease when those standards are in place.
Yes. Well, let me remind everybody who you are. We're drawing near the end. We are talking with Barbara Fisher. Barbara is an unusual professional, an MSW, a PhD in psychology. Barbara Fisher. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin wishing you all a wonderful day.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Breggin and his lifelong reform work on www.breggin.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.